This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Morning Run, weekdays 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris, and I've got Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng here with me. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jumped the gun there a little.
Yeah, too excited. I can't wait to say something, Sharad.
No, it's not that. It's a weekend. I think Fridays always stir in me a sense of deep...
It has a soft spot in your heart.
Doesn't it for you too?
Yes,
I mean,
very
at the end
much
of the
so.
Week, it's a time to rest, it's a time to play, it's a time to catch up with, you know, domestic chores.
I just need to get over 8 a.m. and then it's weekend for me.
Ooh. I mean, on every
because
day.
8 a.m. is a big grill, right?
Oh yes, that's right. So we've got a big grill coming up today, but I'll tell you about that in a little while. In fact, why don't I tell the big surprise of who it is on the breakfast grill right now? It's Christoph Mueller, the man in charge of the turnaround plan at Malaysia Airlines, the CEO himself. Now, if you remember, was it last month that he surprised markets by announcing that he was going to resign ahead of the end of his contract. So it's a 3-year contract, and he's going to step down in September, which makes it 2 years in.
Okay, so technically that was a surprise. Him being on the breakfast grill is not a surprise because we put it out two days ago.
Maybe it could be a surprise for some.
Yeah, it could be if you're not following us on Twitter.
He did surprise us when he pulled out of a breakfast grill previously.
Yes.
And a few days after that, he announced his resignation.
That's
so
right,
I'm
yeah.
glad we are part of history.
In some minor, in a footnote somewhere. But I think more importantly is that when we put it out a couple of days ago, we solicited questions. We asked our listeners if they would be, you know, they had questions for him. And in fact, many questions did come in. Many of them around the issue of why he stepped down, and we could be completely forthcoming on that issue.
He said it was for personal reasons. If someone asked you, Sharad, something super personal that you didn't feel right to share with the public, and you said, well, it's personal, and nobody respected that, would that be okay with you?
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, having grown up on a diet of things like House of Cards.
Grown up with it.
You had a fantastic childhood.
Well, no, I mean, I haven't had a growth spurt since I hit 50.
Okay.
But, you know, the real issue is it seems evasive when you turn up for work and you say, well, I have a stomach problem. You know, people say, oh, yeah, right. You know, because the stomach problem has become a way of, evading true transparency. And so I think the personal issue, there might be personal issues. I'm not saying that there aren't. I'm just saying that in the minds of many, there might have been more. And I think that's what people are hankering for. They want some... honest speaking, they want just, you know, people who are in either in the corporate world or in government to speak plainly and honestly about things.
So do you think that if it is if it was truly a personal problem, would you still expect him to come out and reveal the details of his private life
for me, I'm willing to accept if he in fact says, you know, it was a personal reason, there's personal reasons for why I'm going, I'm more than happy to accept those posts. I don't want to push him for what those reasons are. But what I do want to know was if he was driven out of his position. That's, for me, the key question.
Or he quit in protest.
Driven out, right?
So in which case, then, it's not a personal issue, right? Because when we say personal, we don't mean whether he...
Well, it could be personal. It could be, you know, not getting along with someone. That's a personal thing.
Personal is just a euphemism. It's just a euphemism for saying... let's not get anyone losing their faces, right, or let's not get anyone in trouble by airing your dirty laundry.
Well, see, that's it. You're saying euphemistically, so that's again, it's an innovation.
I'm not defending it, but he could be saying personal, but when it's actually not.
So how often does he have to repeat that it's personal for everyone to believe it? Because apparently, looking at the questions, a lot of the questions that came in from Twitter and Facebook were simply, what's the real reason that you're leaving?
Okay, so the question is, if you want to go down the personal route, I mean, I'm not talking about Mueller here, I'm just talking about in general. And you're a public official, you're in elected office, for instance. You need to say something more than it's personal. You'd have to actually say something that can be verified. So then you will stop the talk. Otherwise, if you leave it at the it's personal, you won't. I mean, say, we had a chief minister and he resigned. He said, well, it's personal. We'd want to know why. And we want to know, and we want to have some evidence of that explanation so that it can be triangulated, it can be verified from independent sources. I mean, that's the only way to stop that line of questioning, right? So until that is done, I'm not saying that this is something that's incumbent upon the man who, heads the national carrier, but I'm just saying that I can see why people continue to ask this question.
Well, his reasons for resigning, that's just one part of the many things we're going to be talking to him about. Julian, what will you be focusing on? Are you thinking about where we are in terms of the turnaround plan for Malaysia Airlines?
Absolutely. I mean, they have got about a 6 billion ringgit funding support from Khazana, and it's very specific what they can use that for. I'm going to ask them how they're using that. Also, their strategy. They have embarked on a strategy of cost-cutting. What will happen to revenues going forward, how much you're doing for revenue building. And also the issue of, and this is something that we have been talking a lot about as well, the issue of the imperative of having a national airline, right? What does he think? What does he as a foreigner think about it?
Okay, all these questions and more on The Breakfast Grill today, 8 a.m. with the man himself, Christoph Mueller, CEO of Malaysia Airlines. Also coming up on the show, current affairs at 8:35 a.m., we explore best practices in other countries to achieve transparency and accountability in government institutions. So if you remember recently, the MACC, the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, uncovered a syndicate that allegedly siphoned off 100 million ringgit from the Youth and Sports Ministry. So in the wake of this discovery, that ministry, the Youth and Sports Minister, Khairi Jamaluddin, cited procedural weaknesses, and he claimed that higher level approvals were not needed for government payments. So this scandal has reignited the questions that many have raised about the management of government funds and the effectiveness of audit practices in the ministry.
Well, it saw Bangladesh losing about $80 to $90 million as a result of a heist that I suppose can be said to be as a result of this kind of procedural weaknesses. I mean, they want to steal almost $1 billion, but I think they got away with just enough.
Yeah, well, actually, the Bangladesh case is interesting. Whether the security systems, that govern the flow of, kind of electronic money is secure, as opposed to, signing checks and, shifting money on, that happens when, governments are involved in transfers of money and, allocations and stuff. I think those kind of procedural weaknesses, the second, is what we're really talking about in the Malaysian case. In the Bangladeshi case, I think it's still up for grabs. I've been following the recent developments of that, but it's such an interesting thing, because if it's possible to hack the central bank, then and is it just because Bangladesh didn't put all those safeguards in place, or are all central banks in danger of being hacked and having these electronic heists?
Well, apparently it started with something as simple as a thumb drive, malware in a thumb drive in a USB port. And I think you're, in a small way, I think all mega institutions are vulnerable, but to what degree of vulnerability? Maybe some institutions have, you know, recognized and put up measures to stop that early, but Bangladesh could have been, you know, an unfortunate victim.
I mean, if you think of the old bank heists, right, and how they were stuff of not only legend but also movies, because there was drama to it. There were people.
This is no different.
Digging holes. No, well, actually, if you're just sort of tapping away at your laptop in a Starbucks in, you know...
No, it was more elaborate than that. So,
it was three groups. One from Pakistan, North Korea, and the other still unidentified.
They had to doctor banking instruction codes, SWIFT codes, and they had to hide codes from their bosses, setting up fictitious accounts. It's good old bank heist.
Well, okay, so it's a good old bank heist, all done behind a laptop, right? So you don't have people digging up things, the vans in the alley.
With explosives.
No, you had to go to the bank to get the money.
The love affairs that happen as a consequence.
And the high-speed car chases.
So all I'm just saying is, this new form of thievery just might rob us of great storylines. But you're right, I might be, you know, speaking too soon,
I'm
Julian.
Sorry, I think this is a great storyline, by the way. Hollywood, pay
absolutely
attention.
Absolutely fantastic.
So coming up, another show that I'd like to flag for you this morning is the property show. Azra Rahman is going to be talking about PTPTN loans and how it affects your mortgage application. Now, poor repayment of PTPTN loans is the cause for rejection of many of the applications of graduates wanting to buy cars, properties, to obtain credit cards. Now, this is because their records have been included in the Credit Central Reference Information System, or CRIS, database, and that's part of PTPN's effort to recover approximately 8.3 billion ringgit of unpaid loans. So really, I think it's quite interesting when you think about student debt. Now, student debt in America is a huge problem, but here I don't think we talk about it that much, you know?
Student debt?
Yeah.
No, I think there's, in fact, a huge discussion around the PTPTN
loans. PTPTN loans and why people why students don't pay back, right?
Yeah, and...
Because they can't afford to.
They can't afford to.
Well, yes, there's that, but, you know, there are a lot of people who complain that they can't take their... budget holidays in Bali, whatever, because now, you know, they've been
barred
from leaving the country. And actually, the question is, if you can go for a holiday, why can't you pay your loan? And I believe, you know, there was a huge campaign around this. There were members of the federal opposition who said that, in fact, there should be a debt relief and, you know, PTPTN loans should be written off. And there are deep ethical questions that arise from this, which has to do with, you know, your moral obligation. You took a loan, knowing it was a loan. And to what extent many Malaysians feel entitled to that money.
The thing is that if you are running a government that should be interested about things like minimum wage, good security for the country, good education, good housing, the question of this is whether these students should be given the right to have a stab in having a good future, right? It's one thing to tell them that this is a loan, this is almost a commercial type of loan, which, by the way, I gather that the interest rate is quite cheap. It's about 1%.
Yeah,
so
it's
not necessarily a commercial loan. But on the one hand, the government is giving this loan to you and saying, go study. And on the other hand, what is the national aspiration? Do you want to create a well-informed, educated base? And which leads to a point that is being discussed in America right now, are free colleges. Is this something that we need in Malaysia?
But we've got 8 billion plus ringgit in terms of unpaid loans at the moment for PTPTN. Think about the future students who don't get that opportunity to take the loan because you never repaid the loan.
8 billion is nothing.
And I'm saying this as someone who took out a PTPTN loan while I was studying in local university.
Okay.
Yeah, I got a PTPTN loan. I have to tell you, it was really helpful. And I don't think I could have gotten through my university years without the help of a PTPTN loan.
And did you pay it back?
I've paid it all off.
I think education is the right. That's my problem with asking back for your pound of flesh, right? Because if you had no education, destroys the country as well. So
my concern is this, and I'm kind of on both sides of this debate, right? If things were arranged differently, if we could ensure that education was both affordable and of good quality, because we just want to have free education that's low quality, which is a reality, right? It's a possible scenario. A lot of free education, access to education, but actually low quality education that takes you nowhere. The question is, and on a personal basis, when you've taken a loan, right, and then you say, well, I don't want to pay it back, I think one has to really dig deep as to the motivations of that. Are you going to use, these are now tools.
It's not that they don't want to pay it back.
Could I
they
also
can't,
say...
No, that's not true, Julian.
Wait, the minimum,
a lot of people can pay it back.
The monthly payments are quite low, I have to say. The monthly payments are $100 over. But can I just say that this comes back to financial literacy. When at the point of receiving the money and you sign the loan papers, right, it's so simple that you don't think it's a loan. You don't see it as a loan. You just think of it as, oh, it's my tuition paid, or someone banks in. You don't think of it as a loan because every semester in your account, money magically appears.
You know what is actually at stake here is also a very well-developed culture of entitlement. And I think that is something that is poisonous and toxic for the nation. And unless we make sure that, a right is not the same as an entitlement, right? Though a rights-based discourse might, in fact, lead to a culture of entitlement, which says, well, you know, it's mine, and I think that is something that has really been very toxic for the nation, and it's part of the discussion on PTPTN.
I think that you need to have a more holistic approach to this whole education thing, because it affects other areas of your life as well. There's very high youth unemployment today. And I think that education is not a luxury good, like how you would buy a watch or a car. You know, education is something that is basic and that is needed. So the idea of a debt relief for education, I think, is not something that can be dismissed so easily.
I wouldn't dismiss it either.
PTPTN loans and how it affects your mortgage application is the topic for the Property Show today with Azra Rahman. Make sure you tune in 9:35 a.m. Right now it's 6:16 and we'll be back with more in just a few minutes on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Led Zeppelin there with Going to California. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng. 6:21 on Friday, the 13th of May. Friday the 13th and 13th of May. This is like a double whammy of bad luck or bad news all around.
But this is, partly about, the way in which meaning is attached to particular dates. And I don't think we need to be terrified by it or, continue to carry this baggage.
Are you superstitious about Friday the 13th? Let's talk about Friday the 13th first.
I'm not superstitious about anything.
Yeah, I'm not.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not a superstitious person.
Okay. Well, I have problems with the number 13 and...
Would you not buy an apartment? Somebody sold you an apartment and it was on the 13th floor. You mean,
I have gone to view an apartment that was on the 13th floor and... decided against it.
What do you think was going to happen? Like they would collapse?
I don't know, I just didn't like the number 13. And also because it was 12A.
I mean, people who indulge in, this kind of garden variety in numerology, right? Because there's 13.
Variety.
Yeah, and then it's like 1 plus 3 is 4 and 4
okay,
is
I don't take it that
bad.
Far.
Because,
some
buildings have a double whammy, right? You have the whole kind of Chinese superstition around the word 4, and then you have this kind of Hollywood imported superstition around the word 13th. And so 13 floors and 4 floors disappear on buildings.
Okay, so
are
you telling me you are not superstitious at all? At all?
No, I can say that I'm not.
Yeah, I would say
with the numerology is quite interesting. If enough people believe in them, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy so that the house that's numbered 4 or 13 may not sell well. And then you have a real financial impact to your superstition.
Paraskevidekatreaphobia is what it's called. The fear of Friday the 13th. The fear of the number 13 itself is...
What?
Paraskevidekatreaphobia.
And how ancient is
it? It comes from the Greek word paraskevi, meaning Friday, and dekatria, meaning 13.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just because it's Greek doesn't mean it's ancient. I mean, there's modern Greek, and
that's
so,
true.
Yeah.
But this is the clinical term for fear of Friday the 13th.
It must be ancient.
It's a sickness. In fact, I would agree. It is a kind of sickness.
It is
a kind of a sickness. I mean, superstition is very interesting, right? And people see, superstition is part of, you know, older belief systems. You know, so they really have the same, I think, you know, quality as some forms of religious belief, I think. Mm-hmm. I believe that, you know, you really can't explain things rationally or using science, then really you shouldn't be holding on to those beliefs.
So I think there are also a lot of cultural influences to it, even though if you were going to be science-based, right? For example, if you walk through the cemetery at night, you would still feel a little bit scared, even eerie, though you were scientific. And that's because I think you were brought up in a certain way, in an environment where it's culturally, that culture thinks about ghosts, and therefore you feel that.
Yeah, I have those buttons. As a child, I loved ghost stories. I insisted that I was told ghost stories, only be terrified, not want to have a bath without the door.
I'm sure
being
you
left
still
open.
Get freaked out by the odds. Story or two.
You know, I rarely say feel spooked, but I have had occasions. You know, I lived in a hotel in Thailand on campus at the University of Chulalongkorn, and across from my room, a murder had taken place, a very famous murder, a doctor who killed his wife and then minced her down and flushed her down the toilet.
Oh,
minced
goodness.
Her up and flushed her down the toilet.
How did he do that?
With great precision and
with what, hacking her into pieces?
Yeah, he was a doctor, right? So I think he must have had, you know, access to scalpels. He literally kind of like shaved it down into bits, you know, and flushed it down into the sewage system. But you know, more importantly was everybody felt that the place was haunted, and they were like, when I first came, I saw the pictures of, you know, communal prayers, and I thought, oh, that's nice, people are so religious, and you know, it's nice that they get together and pray. I didn't realize it was about, you know, chasing away evil spirits or ghosts or an unhappy woman who
hunting one day, Shira.
Wow. Well,
okay, I'll sit out that little excursion there.
I think better luck at fishing.
The other significance the date has, Friday the 13th of May, of course, is from the May 13 riots.
Yeah, so I think that political event really traumatized the nation. I think that
is more damaging, perhaps, than Friday the 13th.
Yeah, and how do countries, survive that? I think often when it comes to violence, looking back, having a truth and reconciliation process, having reports that give transparency to those murky circumstances. These are the only ways in which we deal with those national traumas and we can move on. Unfortunately, May 13 has been used and continues to be used by some, you know, irresponsible parties, politicians who think that this is a way of garnering support for themselves or cowering opposition to them. So that, unfortunately, has given May 13 its, you know, its lasting effects.
Do you think there's a taboo surrounding this that we don't want to acknowledge or talk about it much?
Both of you guys,
what do you think? Do you think we are open to talking about it?
I think more so than, you know, I've seen over the last 20 years a real transformation in terms of people's attitudes towards May the 13th. And I think, the old days, you know, every time people were spooked, you'd see a run on the supermarkets, right? Basically, stocking up for... I mean, who does that anymore? Who stocks up for
rice? I think
rice?
People still do. People buy bags of rice and cans of food. And the problem is that this has been used as a kind of spectre to say that if you don't do as we say, you'll end up in that kind of situation, a very racial type of situation, which is of course undesirable, but we really have to go back to exploring it. And whenever we talk about it, we are like stepping on eggshells, right?
Yeah.
We have not had a proper, honest discussion about it, but more so, it's a good thing that we're opening up.
Well, there's another racial riot before May the 13th that we may not be quite familiar with. Apparently, it happened, when was it? Was it a year?
The year before May 13th. It happened on May 13, 1 year earlier.
Oh, it happened on May 13 itself.
Because, coming out of the the war, we've had many incidents. I mean, not only racial riots, but we had, you know, class-based riots. We had lots of tensions. We had the interregnum, which is that period after the Japanese occupation, before the British forces took over, where there was a lot of bloodletting. And so, you know, it was a very volatile time. You remember, we had a civil war between 48 and 1960, which is called the emergency. I mean...
So credit to Chili Sauce, the website that did the investigation into this other May 13. It's very interesting. It started because at that point in time, Malaysia just moved over to printing our own currency. But there were two currencies in circulation, one that was linked to the British, and ringgit. And then the other one was the actual ringgit issued by the country. And at the time, the one that was linked to the British devalued because the British pound devalued, and that the value of that ringgit, that particular ringgit, devalued by 15%. Of course, many people who were still holding a currency when rioters went up in arms, and that escalated into something that was quite racial as well.
There you go. A little bit trivia of history right there.
So devaluations, we've had a rich history of devaluations.
6:30 right now, time for the first news bulletin of the day with Audrey Raj. That's next on BFM 89.9. The station, that was Jacob Dylan earlier with Something Good This Way Comes. You're listening to me, Melissa Idris, also with Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng. 6:40 on the clock. And in its March quarterly update, the Oxford English Dictionary has added 19 new terms to its lexicon, 19 new Singapore English terms. These are in the new sense of a word, common English words, but loan words from Chinese and Malay, and formations in English that are used in Singapore and Malaysia, and also Hong Kong.
It's look at the list. I mean, does it include words like yum cha and shok and what is the other?
So wa shok and yum cha. Those are all.
Blur is there too.
All, yep. Blur's in there as well. Sabo.
Blur is an interesting word because it, in fact, is, as it were, a proper English word, but it's been given new meaning by its misuse in Singapore, right?
Meaning slow in understanding. So if you didn't understand it, you're very blur. La.
Angmo has also been included into this dictionary.
Yeah, see, this is interesting because Angmo, I think, it's quite old as a word, right? Isn't it referred to redhead devils?
It's Hokkien. It's Hokkien for Caucasians.
And doesn't it come from the 19th century?
What is the direct translation of that?
Ang is red and Mo is, I guess, ghost or something.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I'm not sure, actually.
All right.
Yeah, something like that. Redhead verify devils that. Or something. Yeah. But, you know, I think that these stories that come out in the media often excite people, partly because a Malaysian reading this list of Singaporean English words will say, hey, hold on. You know, half of that list is actually Malaysian, and shouldn't we have ownership of that?
Especially,
shouldn't we be given credit?
Especially terms like lepak and teh tarik. Are you kidding me? It's Malaysian.
Well, to be fair, the OED says that lepak and teh tarik are characteristics of both Singapore and Malaysia English. So
okay.
They're attributing it to two countries, but I say it's ours, you know? It's ours.
This could get quite nationalistic.
No, there's also this other thing, because, you know, it's an opportunity to remember what language is like. I mean, I think Malay is very much like English in that it's rich with loan words. I used to have a little dictionary that would tell you the provenance of a word. It would tell you whether a word had Arabic or Hindi or Tamil origins, or, you know, whatever the it might be. I mean, think of the words like garfu and spatu, which are Portuguese. So you can almost, you know, without being an expert in the field, sort of trace it back to the time that the Portuguese, you know, were here, you know, in 1511, and Almari, right, which is a Malay, you know, which
Portuguese,
is
right?
It's Portuguese, but yeah. it's also a Malay word, right? In the sense that we've taken, so the borrowing, right? You can think of actually Malaya as, you know, being on the Straits of Malacca, being this incredible, you know, shipping lane, right, through in the ancient world, just being rich with all these exchanges, not just of goods and stuff, but also of language. And so I think Malay reflects that richness. And we often forget, we're always excited. I think the news always picks up the entry of our words into the English dictionary. But it's been traveling all kinds of way is Malay words into the Chinese lexicon, Tamil words into the Malay lexicon and such.
A quick tweet from Jerry9453. He says, "Mo is hair in Hokkien, so yeah. Red hair." Okay,
I got,
thanks so
I got
much.
That from my friend as well, Ravinder Singh, who is not Chinese.
Ooh, very good.
He told
good.
Me the meaning of Ang Mo. It means red hair.
And red hair.
If you say Ang Mo Kui, means it's red hair ghost.
Ghost or devil, yeah.
So, thank you, Ravinder.
And so that was part also of China's kind of history of foreign intervention, you know, the carving up of China during the 19th century and then into the 20th century, and all those wars and pushback, right? I think of the Opium Wars and such. So very exciting histories around these words, because it's about how people think of each other. I mean, Indonesia developed, and I think Sukarno during the Konfrontasi developed a lot of jokes about Malaysia and Malaysians and the Malay language to try and assert Indonesian superiority, right? So to this day, when I go to Indonesia, somebody will say, perhaps an older generation will say, is it true that in your country the army is called Henta Henta?
Which, what?
You know, as opposed to tantra, right? Because hanta hanta would be the sound of the marching.
Thing, right? Okay.
So, and you know, and there are all kinds of things, you know, that a maternity hospital was called, you know, hospital korban lelaki, which means, you know, a victim of, you know, a victim
korban
of men.
Lelaki.
Why is it men? Why are men?
The women are the victims of men because they got pregnant by men. Okay, so.
Well, okay. Naren Ramakrishna just said that they can have sabo, but lepa is all ours. I completely agree with you, Naren. I am claiming lepa as a Malaysian word. Singapore can have sabo. The Oxford Dictionary, according to Spider on the Web, or his handle SX8Z. Am I reading that right?
Yes.
Okay, so he says that the Oxford Dictionary can the Oxford Dictionary add a word for pedas to its lexicon? Hot or spicy is not pedas. Do you agree? Is there an English equivalent for pedas?
I don't know.
That's always because the hot is a kind of inadequate word.
Hot is temperature.
Yeah. But it's spicy also, doesn't mean it burns your tongue as well.
Yeah, because it could be flavorful, yeah. Spicy, yeah. Right? But hot does have you can talk about chilies bringing a kind of heat to food. And you've watched enough food shows, you'll get that, won't you?
I think it's not, I guess the writer is saying it's not nuanced enough. But also, I just want to highlight that there is this amazing Wikipedia entry on Singlish. Singlish, of course, is a kind of what they call an English-based Creole language or a kind of pidgin, right?
Okay.
So, for example, they explore certain phrases, what they call the sociolect continuum of Singaporean English in basilect. This guy's English C-base, and then they have the mesolect exploration.
Can you say that on radio?
I have no idea what it means.
Oh, gosh.
Then the mesolect version is this guy's Singlish damn good A. So this is an amazing Wikipedia entry that is so entertaining and technical at the same time.
Okay, why don't you put the link there
and we'll tweet it out.
There's also, I mean, this is when, you know, Asian countries share things and maybe we don't sometimes see that as important. And there's a bit of controversy around the word kongsi. And if you know something about the history of the word kongsi, so if you look at some of the online discussions about the meaning of kongsi, it's a noun, and it's often at least in Wiki Dictionary, for want of a better source, a benevolent organization of popular origin found among overseas Chinese communities for individuals with the same surname. Now, my contention is, and I think in fact it's been a part of some sort of discussion, that actually it's of Malay origin. And so, and you know, partly to do with Sun Yat-sen's residence in Penang for a while, and then and because Kongsi is not just the word for, you know, the organized, it's a concept, right? And that expansion of the concept really happens in Malaya.
There was some controversial discussion about this. I think the word origin is Chinese, but there is a more Malay nuance to the thing, because the Chinese meaning of it is clan or corporation, whereas in Malay, it means to help each other, right? Kongsi, or to split the bill or to split the burden or something. And then maybe our friend Chiang Kai-shek borrowed it back from
Perhaps. I, for one, when I read stories like this, I sometimes have difficulty translating Malay words to English because there's no right translation for it. And I wish that the Oxford English Dictionary will pick up some of the words that don't have an English equivalent. My nomination to Oxford would be manja. Is there an English word translation for the word manja? Someone please tell me.
No, right. There isn't.
Okay, so just a quick correction. It wasn't Chiang Kai-shek, it's Sun Yat-sen.
I'm sorry.
Right? Okay, Chiang Kai-shek was the general, right? But yeah, manja is lovely. It's
is it? So it's like loving and
solicitous, right? Because you can dote on a child, but what does a child do to you to get that feeling that you need to dote on it?
Yeah.
It is a kind of solicitous.
So there's some
kind of like
so manja. Yeah, what is the word?
I don't know.
Good Lord, someone
well,
tell me.
Yeah, so
it's not spoil.
So Shungan is
our producer
and he's suggesting spoil, but actually manja is not spoil.
No, it's not spoil.
Well, manja in the sense of the word, it's behavioral. So spoil, I do agree, in a small sense, it is to spoil a child, to pamper a child, is to manja a child, right? Don't spoil the child too much. But manja in the sense of the behavior, if you're talking about a relationship, someone who's, what is the word? I don't have an English translation.
No, that's why I think solicitous, right? It's about how you are able to elicit a feeling.
Coquettish, perhaps?
Well, that's very gendered. It's really about women, and it's got a much more kind of sexual connotation to it. Whereas manja is much more open. It seems to be less sexual in nature and really about trying to draw the person to an
affectionate.
You know, creating bonds, right? So they're bonds that are very childlike often in its nature. But yeah, it's a beautiful word. And I can see English lexicographers, you know, pulling their hair out.
Oxford, call me.
There is this other website which asks for about 38 wonderful foreign words that we could use in English. For example, palinti, which is a Ghanaian word. Your friend bites into a piece of piping hot pizza, then opens his mouth and sort of tilts his head and says, ah, the Ghanaians have a word for that, and it's called palinti, right?
I know,
that's a great word.
I know exactly the feeling, the sensation you're talking about. I know exactly.
The Thais have a word called...
Ghanaians, is it?
Yeah, Ghanaians. The Thais have a word called grengjai, that feeling you get when you don't want someone to do something for you because it would be a pain for them. It's really nuanced and specific. I think there are so many emotions that the English language have not developed to handle.
So wait, I mean, I think the base, the heart of the story is when words travel. And I think that's important, because why put it in the English dictionary unless it's already traveled and become part of an English-speaking part of the world, which is not just Britain or the Americas. It's, of course, got to do with all the ex-colonies where English flourishes.
6:52 right now. We'll be back at the top of the hour with the news bulletin at 7 on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.